Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Cowboy Wisdom NLI Radio. NLI is Neuro Linguistic Innovation. Tonight we have the author of Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay, Montgomery Granger. And we're going to open your eyes and open your wisdom to understanding how the prison system works, but also how the Army and the people in the Army are actually peacemakers of the world when people allow them to engage with the people around them. And anyway, without any further ado, I want to welcome Montgomery to the show. Welcome, Montgomery.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate being on, Bob. It's always a pleasure, and I appreciate your kindness and your support very much.
Well, here's the thing. People really have to open up to understand the people that are engaged in the day-to-day actually can expand the people's wisdom to really understand. And you was engaged in the day-to-day operation and dealing with detainees. And Montgomery, enlighten the people on what you learned when you first started engaging with these people.
Well, the first thing I learned, Bob, was that it was tantamount to an emotional train wreck because I hadn't been there about 24 hours. Feeling sorry for myself, angry and hurt and upset that I had to be separated from my wife and children, a two-day-old baby included. And there I was on the tarmac at the Leeward Airport at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, observing detainees being taken off the aircraft to be added to those that were already in Camp X-Ray at the time. And it was an emotional train wreck. I felt genuine hatred for the detainees, but at the same time, as a medical service officer, not a medical professional, but responsible for oversight of medical, preventive medical, and environmental aspects of the mission pertaining to the detainees. We military personnel choose our jobs, Bob, but we don't choose our missions. And I don't think any of us could have predicted the clash of feelings that we experienced during the incarceration mission. And as I said, I describe it as an emotional train wreck, but once hating them because they're the reason I was away from home, but also feeling compassion for their humanity and their predicament. And I think all of us struggled with it at one point or another. And I think you and every American can be proud of 99.9% of all military service people serving at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, because they rose to the occasion. We did our jobs. We treated each and every detainee with dignity and respect. And for that, we got spit on, got urine and feces thrown on us, insulted, threatened, and many, many attempts at manipulation. So it was a very conflicting, difficult, challenging job. And I don't want to compare this, though, to those who were engaged in direct combat with the enemy. That's a completely different thing. And I spent almost a year in Iraq in combat environment. So I'm not equating it to that. But everyone has their own reality, Bob. And the reality of Gitmo is that it's an extremely challenging mission for anybody, military, police, or medical personnel.
Now, let me ask you this. This is the question I've had. Do you think we went into the Iraq war not really understanding the temperament of the people we were engaging with?
That's a good question. I think we learned a lot about Iraqis. If you're my age or older, you might have remembered before 1979 when the Shah of Iran was in Iran and there was peace in the Middle East, relatively speaking, and then there was the war between Iran and Iraq. And I think the image of Iraq that we had before that was of Saddam Hussein, a dictatorship. And if you remember, our country picked the lesser of two evils, the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Mujahideen al-Haq, which were the now the expatriate nationalists who want to overthrow the mullahs, but at the time they were behind the overthrow of the Iranian government and actually kidnapped many of our folks over there in Tehran, Iran. For 444 days they were held hostage. And we sided with Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war, more or less. And my personal view of Iraqis before the spring of 2003 was generally positive, the people that was, because when I was a teacher in New York City public schools, I coached baseball, I had an Iraqi diplomat's son on my baseball team. And he's now an engineer in Colorado, and he stayed here. So I learned a lot about Iraq or Iraq's people through this young man and his father, who are very well educated. It's one of the places where the Bible tells us civilization started. So, you know, very learned people. We also learned a lot, Bob, about the Iraqi people in the first Gulf War. In my unit, although I was not serving with them then, but the unit I ended up with, the Enemy Prisoner of War unit, served in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Iraq during that campaign and got to interact up close and personal with Iraqi soldiers. And I think any soldier, uniformed soldier, I'm not talking about Al-Qaeda and Taliban and terrorists and Islamist extremists, but any soldier can find common ground. Because once the bullets start flying, it's about staying alive and helping your buddy stay alive. And so there was some mutual respect. These soldiers followed Geneva Convention rules. They were held, I think, no more than 3 or 4 days after the war was over. They were all released because they were lawful combatant prisoners of war. And then comes spring 2003. And again, you saw us confronting regular Iraqi troops. And that was a very quick war, that part of it. Even some of our soldiers who were captured were well cared for, and they followed Geneva Convention. But after major war was over and the insurgency started, that's when things started to change. And I think my interactions with the Iraqi people in Iraq were all positive experiences, from the shopkeepers and military contractors that I came in contact with, and even people from the Iraqi Department of Human Relations. They had folks visiting the Abu Ghraib prison where I was stationed for a while. This was after the scandal. We worked hand in hand with them. And with the ICRC, which is the International Committee of the Red Cross. So I think the Iraqi people were very grateful, at least my experience was, that we were there, that we had cut the head off the serpent, as it were, deposing Saddam Hussein. But what came after, I think, one of our mistakes was Mr. Bremer, who was, I guess, put in charge of the occupation phase. I don't think he learned the lessons from World War II. World War II, afterwards, you had the Marshall Plan. We dealt with the Nazis and separated them from the German soldiers and had war crimes trials, tribunals, military commissions. Japan was another occupation, and Italy. And believe it or not, we still have troops in these countries, yet we don't have anybody in Iraq anymore. And I don't know if you've been reading the paper, Bob, but it looks like Iran has allowed overflight of Iraq in to help the Syrian regime. And there's a now there's a security vacuum in Iraq because of Barack Hussein Obama's policies. And we have lost our power projection platform, meaning we have lost the ability to project power and influence into Iran from Iraq, and it's causing problems.
Well, here's something. You just hit on a couple things that were quite unique there. Not only Iran, but North Korea is also starting to raise its head again.
Well, they sense weakness. They smell blood. It's like blood in the water, and the sharks are circling.
And that's it. But here's the thing. For me, as an American citizen, we have military people over there, and it's the interaction of the military people and the civilians that really open up the lines of communication to changing people's way of looking at America, wouldn't you feel?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a man in the street. And this, I think, was severely lacking in almost all the mainstream media coverage we had from Iraq the whole time we were there. And still, you don't see any man in the street interviews. How are things going today? How did, you know, what's your reaction to this and that? Because now, the Iranian secret police, who's siding with the Shiite power in that country, feel you know, a brotherhood, a kinship. The Hussein regime, Saddam Hussein regime, were the bad guys. So now the government in Iraq is more friendly with the Iranians than they are or ever have been with us. And it's kind of like, well, thanks for nothing.
You know, and we went in there, but we didn't go in there to communicate with them. Don't you feel? That's something that I'm really starting to understand more and more every day. We went in there to show them our power rather than go in there and communicate them and show a better way of life. Wouldn't you feel? Or am I looking at it with a glass half empty?
No, I think that's a perceptive way to look at it. You know, Sun Tzu said once that the military seeks not conquest but victory. And it's a subtle difference between conquest and victory. The military is trained to complete a mission. And the civilian authorities, the commander-in-chief to the Department of Defense, are civilians in charge of the military. They tell us what to do and where to go. And they can't always tell us how to do it. This idea of winning the hearts and minds has always been a tricky thing. We almost succeeded in Vietnam. Contrary to popular belief, there are lots of great books being written now from veterans of Vietnam who talk about the Tet Offensive in 68-69, where the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong took over every provincial capital, some for a few days, some for a few weeks. But what's coming back in these books and stories and what was always suspected is that they spent all their material, all their beans and bullets in that one attack. And if we had counterattacked and followed them and snuffed out their light, I think you'd have a democracy in Vietnam right now. But instead, Walter Cronkite got on television during the Battle of Hue, the city of Hue, which was one of the cities taken over by the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, and said, "We've lost the war." And that's what stuck in people's minds. And there was no turning back from that. So in Iraq, when we went in, and the army basically surrendered very quickly, you had an opportunity there to say, okay, you're going to keep your jobs, we're going to sequester you on your bases, we're going to filter out all the guys like we did in Germany with the Nazis, we're going to filter out all the Ba'athists who are accused of mass murders, etc. But you're going to keep your jobs, you'll be able to feed your families, you'll be able to go home eventually and live your life in peace and prosperity. Instead, we fired them all. So what did they have to do? How were they going to make a living? And sure enough, you had bad guys. You had Al-Qaeda in Iraq. You had the Iranian secret police. You had a lot of what they called in Iraq, we called Al-Qaeda, the Iraqis called foreigners, because most of Al-Qaeda in Iraq weren't Iraqis. But some were, and some joined that insurgency because they had nothing else to do, nowhere else to go, and found themselves in a situation where they had to support their families, and it was a very difficult situation.
So, to me, just listening to what you said, first of all, the book is Saving Grace. Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay, a memoir of a citizen warrior. And the call-in number to talk with Montgomery is 718-305-6548. But Montgomery, we went in with an offensive, but we didn't have anything planned for after the offensive. Do you feel that, or am I, again, looking at the glass half empty?
Well, I think, you know, from a military standpoint, our friends in Turkey made life very difficult for us. In fact, my unit was supposed to go through Turkey into northern Iraq and set up detention operations there with the 4th Infantry Division. And you may not remember this, but very soon before we made our invasion, the Turkish parliament voted no to allowing U.S. troops, men and material, through Turkey into northern Iraq. They were not going to let us stage a northern invasion. The plan was to block by sea, have the Marines come in from the west, and make a big push from the south and the north all at the same time, and to have airdrops. So it was going to be an overwhelming force, a pincer movement, trapping the Iraqi army against us and Iran. And when the Turkish parliament voted not to let troops through, the 4th Infantry Division, material and men, were in the Mediterranean Sea. So it took weeks for them to get around to near al-Basra in southern Iraq or through Kuwait to make that invasion. And we, my unit, sat at Fort Dix, New Jersey for 6 months. And then we stood down and ended up coming in a year later in 2004. So from the very beginning, the plan had to change. But the military always has a contingency, and we perpetrated that contingency. But the management of the peace was lost. And it was lost because choices were made by certain civilian people. You know, the military, try as it might, is not a good civilian governing authority. In fact, in this country, there's laws against the military acting as police. It's called posse comitatus. It's a law that says we may not make civilian arrests. So it's not a mission that we're trained for. Some of the military police are trained to deal with civilian things, but there are a lot of rules and regulations and laws that prevent them from performing their full duties. So to put us in that position where we had to win hearts and minds hadn't really been successfully done since Vietnam. And it was successfully done in Vietnam. We were winning hearts and minds through the Vietnamization program under then President Johnson. But then, like I said, Walter Cronkite's famous words that we can't win the war destroyed all that progress.
You know, that's the problem that I see. We got too many people that never been in war thinking they understand war. And that, to me, is where this all falls down. Rather than listening to Petraeus or somebody such as been in the battle and understand it, we're afraid to listen to them because we might hear the truth and it's not what we want to be.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
I agree. I mean, Petraeus had the right idea, but you need time. You need commitment. And unfortunately, our current administration has shown they're not committed to anything. We have troops in over 70 countries worldwide, Bob. We're still in countries we defeated in World War II over 67 years ago. There's got to be a reason for that. And to not continue that is shattering to our allies and telling to our enemies. We have to be your best friend or your worst enemy. That has to be what people think of when they think of the United States of America. That's our best friend. Look, we've stayed in these countries 67 years. We helped them rebuild from the destruction of war. Germany, Italy, Japan are now some of the world financial leaders. How prosperous they are, and they're that prosperous because we subsidized their defense. We made sure that written into their constitutions were the fact that they could not spend more than 1% of their gross national product on defense. The rest we would take care of. And so can you imagine if we only spent 1% of our gross national product on defense? What kind of infrastructures and industries we'd be able to provide to our citizens? But we did that because we didn't want the evil of World War II to repeat itself. We didn't want the massive killings and murders and horrible things that went on in the 1930s and 1940s to happen again. The UN was created. We decided to police ourselves, and the leader of that was the United States of America. And when we pulled out of Iraq, what we told the Iraqi people is, you're on your own. We could have definitely negotiated to have a residual force there so that we could continue to project our power and influence in that region. But instead, submitted to the pressures of liberalism and the quote-unquote human rights activists, and got out. And it was completely the wrong decision. And I'm afraid that the same thing is going to happen in Afghanistan, which is completely the wrong thing to do. We need to maintain a presence because the real enemy over there is Iran, and I hate to say it, Russia. Those are the two huge influencers over there, and then you have China. So it's not a safe place, but we need some stepping stones over there, Bob.
Well, see, by not putting in more troops and doing more rebuilding, did we allow Iran and China and Russia to take the wealth of the country to pillage and plunder it, and rather than us build it back into a powerhouse or an economic structure?
Well, it's Katie bar the door. That's one of my football, high school football coach's favorite sayings. You know, if everybody doesn't do their job, Katie bar the door. It was like floodgates opening up. We threw the Iraqi people to the wolves, meaning the Iranians. We just threw them to the wolves. And, you know, to go back in there now, it's going to be tough. It would take a diplomatic miracle to get forces over there. Now, what you and I don't know, or, you know, maybe we don't need to know it, is that we probably have a presence in Iraq, but it's a clandestine presence. So there may be a presence by CIA or shadow warriors or ghost soldiers, whatever it is, but that doesn't project political power and influence. A United States Army Air Force base, a port with United States Marines and Navy personnel in it, projects power and influence. And if we're not there in that form, then anybody with the right amount of money or influence, or materiel, will then go in and gain that influence and power.
And also, with Iran doing what they're doing, they're going to upset the economic structure and really get more control over the petroleum resources, wouldn't you feel?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's part of their total strategy, as it would be anyone's strategy going into Iraq, unless there were a principled, democratic, free country that respected liberty and individual rights, freedom of the press, etc., like we do. So it's anybody's guess what's going to happen in Iraq right now. But I'm telling you, when I heard and read and saw that John Kerry was over there sort of with his tail between his legs asking the Iraqi president to please not let the overflight of the Iranian supplies to Syria, I'm going, oh, man, has this turned around?
Isn't that kind of like a drug addict saying, a drug lord telling a drug addict not to use the drugs?
Yes, and it was all for show because there was no bite. They said there's no stick, there's only a carrot. The carrot is if you cooperate and inspect more of these flights for contraband, we'll let you sit at the table when the government in Syria changes, and you'll be able to have some input to that. That's what John Kerry said, he said in the newspaper. So there's no stick because we have no power or influence in Iraq anymore. We have nothing for Iraq anymore.
But now, if Iraq happened this way, what are the Afghanistan people looking at?
Well, it's an interesting situation, but I tell you what, we won't have anything or any chance if we're not there. All it's going to end up being is like Egypt and Israel, where we give them billions and billions and billions of dollars in aid. And when something happens in that country or they do something we're unhappy with, we go again with our tail between our legs, on our knees, saying, oh, please don't do this, please don't do that. You know, that's not how a superpower should behave. That's not how a country who saved the world from Nazism should behave. That's not how a country who has provided assistance and friendship and material and blood, sweat, and tears to countries we defeated in World War II should behave. We have so much at stake right now, and it seems like political correctness and mainstream media run the government.
And campaign contributions.
Special interests.
Yeah, and see, here's the thing. If we don't have, we got to get back to being an economic power and a military power with an economic prowess to rebuild these countries, such as Iraq, to show them that democracy does work. But what are we really showing them? It's more like, we'll come in and help you, and then we're going to leave when it looks like an opportune time. Is that what you think?
Yeah, we did the exact wrong thing. You're exactly right, Bob. We did the exact wrong thing. A friend stays by you. He does it. He does it. You know, you call your friend, hey, I got a flat tire. You don't come over there and watch him change his own tire and he can't do it and say, well, yeah, you tried. I'll see you later. Have a nice day. You stay there and you actually help him put the jack in place. You pump it up for him. You show him how to turn the wrench. You get the tire out for him. You hand it to him. Let him put it on and you help him tighten those bolts. And wait till, you know, he drives away and go with him. You don't just leave him there. And that's what we've done with Iraq. And it's just foolishness.
And with China's appetite for natural resources with Iraq and Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
we better be really on the ball to what's going on there and quit, you know, letting special interest groups run our life and open our eyes. But do we have the power, the brilliance to understand that to teach you a country that's been like Iraq, democracy, we got to sit there and be the example rather than run away and let them figure it out?
Yes, that's right. And remember, and I'm not trying to be off color here, but a vacuum sucks. It pulls in all the bad guys around it. And that's what Iraq is right now. It's a security vacuum. And just like the attack that we made in spring of 2003, man, there were lots of bad guys in there at that time. You had Abu Abbas living in a suburb of Baghdad. Abu Abbas, if you remember, was the guy who planned the Achille Lauro hijacking and pushed American crippled American Jewish man named Leon Klinghoffer off the cruise ship. And this man was in exile in Iraq when we went in there in 2003. They had training camps, most along the border with Iran, Al-Qaeda and terrorist training camps in that country. They had used chemical weapons against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war. They'd used it against their own people, the Kurds in the northern part. And you know who came to the Kurds' rescue after Saddam Hussein gassed them? The Iranians. So the Iranians have friends in the Iraqi Kurds. So, you know, you've created a situation now where that relationship can flourish. Where the Iranians, you know, were there in 2003 waiting to, you know, join the fight and influence things. And now you have probably the Russians and the Chinese can't get out of each other's way, like you pointed out, to gain control or influence over those natural resources.
Well, see, if anybody thinks Putin's our friend in any way, we're lying to ourselves.
Once KGB, always KGB.
That's pretty much. But I got a question now. You know, here's something that I really come to a realization. As soon as a democracy gives out its first entitlement program, it's soon going to go bankrupt. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think it always needs to be like the philosophy of John F. Kennedy when he created the Peace Corps. It was all about teaching people how to fish. don't go in there with heavy machinery and contractors and build them roads and build them schools. You do it with them. You show them how to do it. And then you have a friend. You have a friend for life. And I think that philosophy has to be renewed. I think the philosophy in this country and how we deal with other countries is you teach people how to fish so they can feed themselves. I have an employee from the former Yugoslavia who went through unimaginable hardships, he and his family. And he is a laborer, and he works under my supervision. And you know what he said to me one day, Bob? He said, all work is good work. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine some Americans saying that and believing it? All work is good work. It's a man that appreciates the freedom and the liberty that we have here.
And, you know, I talked to my brother about this, and I want to say it, and this country is flat-out lazy.
Come on, Bob. Tell me what you really think.
No, I mean, I've been watching it, and I've been paying attention. And I had to go, and here's what really is the truth, Mark. I had to look in the mirror and see where I stood in that situation. You know, because I'm really starting to understand this country, until we get back to thinking work is good, this country's going to go down further.
Yeah, I believe you. I think that we all have to look in the mirror. And
I do. We're out of time again, but go ahead and finish.
No, I was just going to say I have five children, four boys, three are Boy Scouts, one's a Cub Scout, working on an Eagle Project. And, you know, I don't think there's anything better for boys than Boy Scouts because it does teach them those traditional American values. And it's just a wonderful organization, and they're going through some challenging times right now. But I think they'll prevail, and good will always come in over evil, and we'll be able to survive as a country and move forward.
I think we're getting opened up to that. But, you know, Texas, anyway, we could have a long conversation about this. But the book is Guantanamo, Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay, a memoir of a citizen warrior by Montgomery Granger, who was my guest. And Montgomery and all the listeners, I really want to thank you. But Montgomery, I really want to appreciate you for being candid and telling us the truth to open our eyes to new wisdom.
Anytime, Bob. Thank you so much for, again, your friendship, your support, and your kindness. I really am grateful to you. Thank you.
Well, I am too. And give them some wisdom, and I'm going to close out the show.
Roger that.
All right. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry about that. No, just, you know, we are together. I mean, we're all connected, and we have to love each other and help each other and support each other, no matter our background, no matter our philosophy or our religion. We're all Americans, and I think we lose sight of that sometimes and call ourselves hyphenated this and hyphenated that. We're all together. We're all Americans together, and we need to speak with one voice if the world is going to pay attention to us and listen to us and respect us. Thanks, Bob.
And thank you, Montgomery, and all the listeners. I'll be here next Tuesday night with Uwe Pendowski. She is an artist, but we'll have Montgomery back again because I always learn and expand myself about the world with Montgomery. Thank you. And good night, everybody.
Bye, Bob.
Goodbye.